This is the Muscles and Management Podcast, where we build your body and your business. Talking all things training, sports performance, and business for athletes and aspiring coaches to enhance your training and better your career. Muscles and Management is brought to you by Challenger Strength with your host, Jerry DiFilippo.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 86 of the Muscles and Management Podcast. As always, please rate, review, and subscribe if you haven't already. I greatly appreciate it. I was thinking about it. I was having this kind of thought go through my head before, and I've had some inquiries about ads for the show and things like that. And I haven't done it yet, but I'm just waiting for maybe the right one that kind of fits the audience and you guys and all that kind of stuff. And I don't want it to become annoying, but if it's something I can have the opportunity to do, that I'm gonna probably do it. We'll see. I don't know. But the reason I'm bringing this up is I kind of laughed because I hear a lot of these podcasts and the intro is the, ad. Maybe they're worried people are going to skip the ad. So it's we'll put it in the first 30 seconds and do our regular intro after. And I thought to myself, all this time I'm thinking how annoying I am to ask for ratings and reviews every time I do a show. I'm like, I guess at this point it's just my own shameless advertising. But anyway, just a funny thought that I had there. If you guys haven't already, check out last week's episodes. They're great. Episode 85, which is a really good episode. You know, being a sports coach and having a sports coach on the show, Drew Watts, a pitching coach, Chad Martin, two guys that work together with their athletes and really have a good process down when it comes to collaborating and creating a fluidity between what they're doing on both ends of the spectrum. I think even for a listener that isn't in the world of baseball or pitching, I think it's a really good episode to listen to because we're talking about the general idea of how sport coaches and strength coaches can kind of work together when it comes to athletes and making the process better for the athletes and easier for coaches and more effective. So I think that's just an episode all around you should listen to if you're into strength conditioning and want to help athletes get better. You're an athlete yourself and want to know maybe some things you can be looking to do with your strength coach and sport coach in terms of getting them connected and things like that. So check that one out if you haven't yet. And then also episode 84 last week was another good Meathead Monday episode. Talking about structure of speed, strength, and skill work and programming, force velocity profiling, so some different questions on how I do that. And this was a really interesting one, combining high-intensity interval training and resistance training together. I talk about how I utilize circuits for aerobic recovery, aerobic capacity, anaerobic work, hypertrophy, all stuff like that. So check that one out if you haven't. You're going to really like that. I will tell you this, I gotta be honest with you, I didn't anticipate these Meathead Monday episodes turning into these Q&As, but it's been really cool because I'm getting more and more questions on the show or in my DMs, and I always felt pressure to make sure I answered all of them, and it takes a long time, and I thought what better way and what easier way? It's easier to talk than to type for one. And two, it's like I said last week, if I can answer a question and it helps 1,000 people that listen versus, the one person I send it to, I think it's great. And I also think it makes the show a little more interactive. I want to start tagging the people who ask the questions, in my tweets when I put out the show, just to kind of get them interacting. I want to, show you guys that you're going to have a voice and you're going to be heard from and the questions you have will get answered to help people. So, really excited about that. And the questions that have been coming in have been awesome and all different types of questions. If I don't answer your question, it's because I probably feel like I can't answer it and do well with it. I got a question about my grip preference for snatches, and I don't use snatches in training for my athletes. I have nothing against them. It's just not something that I do. So, I couldn't really answer that, so I'm not going to. Find maybe an Olympic lifting style coach who could answer that. So that's just an example of, if I don't answer a couple questions because I feel like I can't answer them the right way to help. So before I keep rambling on, just be on the lookout on Wednesday. We have another episode coming up. Hold on, let me just take a look on who that is going. Oh, this is going to be a huge one, actually. Pete Dupuy, co-founder of Cressy Sports Performance, heads all of the business operations of Cressy Sports Performance, partnered with Eric Cressy, obviously, Cressy Sports Performance. Just a terrific episode about business. We found out about 10 minutes into the episode that we both went to Babson. I'm a half a Babson grad. I transferred out and finished up at Rutgers Business School, but we kind of found out we had that in common, talked about some of the unique components of the business education at Babson, the entrepreneurial experience, starting your own business in college and things like that. Really cool episode related to business and just things you want to know about how to make yourself a better coach, how to make yourself more relatable to athletes and things like that. So helpful for people, you know, who want to create their own business and strength and conditioning, but also just coaches in general. So really excited for that on Wednesday. All right. Without further ado, let's get to some questions here. All right. Question number one, Logan Davis at Logan2Davis. Do I recommend traditional or sumo deadlift for pitchers? Why? Logan, thank you for the question. So I would say when I first saw this, my initial thought in my head was it was funny to me. Looking back, like I would have had a completely different answer to this question like 2 years ago than I would now. My question 2 years ago, or my answer 2 years ago would have been more along the lines of my thought process was like, how can I get movements that we're doing in the weight room to be super, super transferable to sport? And it's like, okay, like the argument that's made for the sumo deadlift for pitchers is the idea that that wider stance, the toes pointing out, like think about if you look at a pitcher when they're making contact with their front foot when they're pitching, that kind of spread stance into their stride. The idea was if you could exert force into that position, it would have a really good transfer to the throwing motion and your velocity and everything like that. So I don't necessarily outright disagree with that. Like I do understand where they're coming from, the people that say this when it comes to like spreading your feet like that. It kind of gets you in a little bit more of that stride-based landing position when you're pitching. But I think we have to be careful of trying to do that with every single movement when it comes to the weight room. Like in my opinion, the deadlift for me isn't a matter of like what of the all those different variations of a deadlift can I pick that mirrors pitching the best. It's more of like, can I use the deadlift to get my legs stronger, to be a conduit to power, like strength increasing power. As we know, power being really important for pitchers, being it's a ballistic motion and it's a lot of force in a small amount of time. I wouldn't get so much caught up in saying like, okay, like if I spread my feet out, my deadlift is going to be that much more transferable to pitching, because quite frankly, if we don't have a good handle on our mechanics as pitchers, and you're doing your work with your pitching coach and things aren't where they need to be with that, like it's pretty useless to say, oh, like I can sumo deadlift 450 pounds. Like I'm going to throw harder than the guy I train with who conventionally or trap bar deadlifts 450. It's like, how well can I transfer the strength and power in my legs in terms of the skill part of what I do in pitching? And I think if you just generally increase your strength or power with your lower body variations, like you see your deadlift contributes to your vertical jump and you then see it contribute to your lateral jump and you're measuring things like that, like I think that's cool. If you want to do your sumo deadlift, like absolutely go ahead. I'm trying to make the point that I don't think it's something that's going to like be the, you know, transformation story you're going to hear on Twitter. Like, oh, this guy added 100 pounds to a sumo deadlift and his velocity went up 3 miles per hour. Like, it's not nearly that simple. And we'd be very naive to think it's that simple. And that's not to say that like a person who goes from 200 to 300 on a sumo deadlift would throw any harder than a person who went from 200 to 300 on a trap bar. Like they're both of their legs are stronger. I don't think it's something we're going to fight tooth and nail on about saying that, oh, my feet are a little bit differently positioned. It's going to directly transfer to the mound, because then we begin that slippery slope of like, oh, why don't I just deadlift with my feet split and my torso counter rotated to my legs, and then I'll turn and I'll pick up the bar and I'll lift it as like I'm exerting force in the exact position I am in on the mound. And that's like a really slippery slope of trying to make things so specific that they become overdone and you start to diminish the entire point of what we're doing in strength training and how that kind of works up the ladder to increase our ability in terms of performance and our skills. So that was a long-winded answer, but I think that's my position on that. Do it if you like to do it and you're comfortable and it's easier for you and your anatomical structure of your body to sumo deadlift, but by all means, it's not like a magic pill that it turns a deadlift into a more effective exercise for a pitcher. So that's my answer on that. Ryan Gaynor at Ryan P. Gaynor. Jerry, you're an awesome follow and you have a great podcast as well. Thank you for the comment. Thank you for the compliment. You're going to make my head gigantic. These headphones will not fit me anymore after all these compliments. I'm just kidding. How is NASM, PES, I want to say he's just asking about the difference between a NASM personal trainer cert and a strength coach cert. Would they be worth looking into? Obviously the CSCS is the pinnacle. So I got a lot of these questions after my thread on the, you know, not having a CSCS last week. I would say that the NASM is a very, very good foundational cert. I think the biggest thing that I like to tell people is you definitely want to have a certification that's nationally recognized and, you know, for insurance purposes and liability as a trainer. Like, I wouldn't train people without a cert. Don't confuse the fact when I say that I don't have a CSCS, that I don't have a cert. I have an ISSA personal trainer cert. It was like the first one that I got just because it was kind of easy to go through online, and it was something that I could have, you know, for insurance purposes. And I renew it every 2 years just to have it back me up. I learned a decent amount from it, but it was more of a personal trainer type certification. The cert that I learned the most from that isn't nationally recognized yet, I think it should be, is the CPPS by Joe DeFranco and James Smith, certified physical preparation specialist. And their level 2 cert is an advanced athletic preparation specialist. I have both of those. Those are two of the most applicable and practical certifications I probably have ever seen. What they did for me and the knowledge that I gained and just the basics of programming, speed training, assessments, just so, so applicable. Like, you're not getting bogged down with 3,000 pages of reading material, but the reading material, you are getting are from actual books that Joe and Jim have written. And the good part about those two guys is they're, and this is kind of how I try to model myself, is they're two very, very smart individuals, but they make things easy to understand for the average coach. And I think that's the most important thing, because if we're putting stuff out there that is very smart and it's very educated and intricate, but it's not easily understood and being able to be applied by your everyday coach, it's useless, right? With that said, the long-winded reason of why I'm going through all this is I got the ISSA to be, nationally recognized and have that behind me. And then after I had that, anything else that I did was more of like a way for me to learn. Like, I wasn't gonna like blast the letters of my certs all over my name and everywhere just because I wanted clout and I thought it was gonna give me more clients. Clients really don't give a shit, quite frankly, about that stuff. Like, they wanna know you can help them. If you're in like a setting of like training general pop people at like a day spa, they might get caught up in certifications. I just feel like that's kind of how it is. And with athletes and parents of athletes and things like that, like in the private sector, at least, like they're coming to you because of the results that you can get, or they've heard that you can get, the word of mouth and things like that. So get a nationally recognized cert just to get your foot in the door with insurance and have yourself protected for liability. After you do that, and a NASM is a good way to go, ISSA, like, these are just basic nationally recognized certifications, that once you have that, you'll be covered in terms of the liability. So do not train people until you get something like that. That'd be my first thing I would say. And then you can work your way up to, obviously, the CSCS. Like, not everybody's going to be like me and have the opportunity to work through the industry without that and get to a point where they just no longer need it. But you can get started without one at first to get some traction, and then get it if you don't have the money or the time or whatever it is, to get it right off the bat. So that would be my answer on that. Get a nationally recognized cert to get yourself started. Anything after that, you could just use as like a way to learn. Don't look at getting all these letters behind your name. Think of like, what do those certs offer in terms of the practical application? Like, the CPPS has an in-person certification that's 2 days long and a weekend. And leading up to that, you have like 6 weeks of reading material to go through. And then there's like a 50-page written test afterwards. It's just really, really good in terms of getting you ready to be a coach and a trainer. So, you know, make sure that after you get that basic, you know, nationally recognized cert for insurance purposes, everything after that is what you can learn from the most. Thank you for the question. All right. This is another CSCS question. I want to just, kind of touch on this. I don't think it's not really a question now that I'm looking at it. I just want to acknowledge it. Andy, Bidachka? I'm sorry, guys. I'm trying here. Thank you for sharing your thread of the CSCS, man. My pleasure. I'm literally in the exact same situation as you. Same story. Get this or else you won't make it and all that. I appreciate all your work and your post. Thank you, Andy. I wanted to just recognize this because I got a lot of nice messages about my CSCS post. So I wanted to make sure that I answered them and didn't ignore anybody on that for the kind words. So thank you. Again, this just reiterates the point that I just made. You know, don't look at it as like, I'm not going to get a CSCS because this guy from New Jersey who is semi big on Twitter doesn't have one and he made it. I don't want to be the person that just stops coaches from getting these things that can help them get to the industry. I'm just making the point that you don't need to have one to get there. You could do it without it, but if you can get it, especially if you want to work in a school or team setting, definitely do. So that's just my other comment on that. Okay, another CSCS question. At the Coach Miller, Nathan Miller. Guys, by the way, if you don't want to hear about the CSCS, I would skip through like maybe minutes like 7 through 16 on this show, because I'm answering a couple in a row on this, and we're going to get to some more, you know, training stuff in a little bit. At the Coach Miller, Nathan Miller. Hey, Coach, I was just reading your thread and was rather inspired by your story of your credibility being built as a strength conditioning coach without the CSCS. Thank you, Nathan. I know you had a lot of studying, trial and error, etc., in your time of strength conditioning as a coach, but what are some tips, resources, etc., you would suggest to somebody else climbing up along the same path? Actually, this is a really good question. I do not have a CSCS, but would love some or any guidance. Thank you. All right, so in terms of tips, like I say this all the time, but I don't think it's ever going to be bad to just say this over and over again if it was every episode. Like the biggest thing for me is just applying, like getting yourself in with a base of knowledge. Think of like your knowledge base, like the first cert that I got and the reading that I did in the first 6 months that I knew I wanted to be in this field. I would kind of explain as like, that's like the $100 that you're putting in like a stock. And the more you're going to make, the more interest you're going to make on that stock. Let's just say you invest in your own knowledge as a strength coach. You put $100 into it. The market return on that $100 is going to be better the more you actually like get out in the field and work with athletes and just try things. Like take those basic concepts you learned and use them. You're going to see what works the best, what works not as well, what works the best for your style and what you're the most comfortable utilizing. What's the easiest to implement with a big group of athletes? What's the easiest to implement with one athlete? Or what can you do extra with one athlete when you have one-on-one attention? The things that I learned the most, like I would say 75% of like what I know now as a strength coach, I did not read about. It was literally like, I could honestly say like training people and saying, oh, like, ooh, like if I add an extra ground contact before this jump, it's going to increase like the power output of it because of like this little thing I read from Yuri Verkhoshansky. And then like slowly, like I'll give you an example, like those pulsing baseball starts that I thought of in terms of getting a good weight shift was just something I experimented with. It was like, hey, like I want to add power to and more velocity side of the curve of the force velocity curve to my sprint. So if I add ground contacts before these sprints, it's going to increase the overall power output through the ground contacts, but also going to make the movement more reactive and more on the velocity side of things. And then I ended up stumbling upon the positions it builds with getting the foot under the hip and making the baseball start easier to grasp for an athlete. Like I didn't read about those things. I learned about them by putting something into a sprint for something else I'd read about and determining that it helped that, but it also did something else completely different that is huge for our success, but I never would have read about that or thought about it. And then boom, there you go. It's something that I could quote unquote came up with without reading about it. So I think that's like the biggest thing that I would say is like the biggest single tip that I have in terms of resources, your experience is probably going to be a top three resource for you as a coach when you're trying to learn. Get with athletes, get around athletes, work for free, go to a PT clinic in your area, tell them you have a certification and you're willing to train some of their clients in after they're done with their therapy for free. I did that for a little bit. Get yourself the ability to, you know, put what you're learning to action, get some results from it. Ask these people if it's okay if you share the results you're getting on maybe social media, build some traction, show people what you do, how you get the results that you get. Explain the result, the way you get the results that you get. Like what I always get told makes me stand out on social media is that if I put something out there and I'm saying this is how this kid's gotten from point A to point B, I'm telling you what is in between A to B. Why we're doing what we're doing, why we're using the concept that we're doing. We're not doing a post-activation, potentiation, you know, contrast training pairing because it looks cool when I saw, you know, Pat Mahomes doing it on Instagram. I'm doing it because I know that that athlete is at the point that they've been training with me for a long enough amount of time. I need to increase their power output because they're entering a peak part of their season or whatever. And we did it. It got them, you know, up a couple ticks on their vertical or their sprint speed or whatever it is. So that is the biggest thing that I would say on that. All right. So I hope that helps with that. Let's see here. Next question. Did I answer? Nope. Hold on. All right. Sorry guys. I've been screenshotting the Twitter questions and then I upload them as, PDFs. I don't know why I tell you guys things. I start to look to myself and I'm like, do they really give a shit about why I'm about this? But I'm telling you anyway. I put the images in like a JPEG or PNG, whatever the hell it's called, on my computer so I could just read them from my screen. So I scrolled the wrong way and I missed the question. So I was like confused for a second. So just wanted to give you guys the heads up on why I paused. This is from Brolic Bilo. Interesting name. Cool name. Brolic. I like it. at BigBailey96. So I'm not sure. I'm not making fun of your name, by the way. I'm assuming Brolic you're putting as like Brolic, like, you know, you're big and you're muscular. But if it's actually your name, then I think it's cool. Do you coach your guys on Olympic lifts? And this is kind of not too much I'm going to be able to explain on this, but the reason I picked it is because it just goes back to my point about the snatch question before that I mentioned on why I didn't answer that. I don't, and it's not because I don't like them, and I've had this conversation with a lot of guests that I've had on the show. It's just because it's not something that I use. It's not something I'm comfortable with teaching, and, you know, I just, it's not for me, and it's not what we use, and I think that's just one of the different ways you could skin the cat that is getting athletes bigger, stronger, and faster. You don't have to use it. You easily can use it. It all depends on what you're comfortable teaching, what you're the most adept at, and, you know, just all of those things. So I don't use them, and I wanted to talk about this because I want to let you guys know that if you like using them, you absolutely can. It depends on what you're able to teach, what your population dictates, like how many kids you have, can you get them to do it with good form, with, you know, if you're just one coach with 20 athletes, do you prefer using loaded jumps, trap bar, deadlifts, things like that? So that's what I would say to that. This is at Welton Jamie, James Welton. Hi, Jerry. I appreciate all the content you put out. It's extremely practical. Well, thank you, James. I'm happy to hear that. I am about to rent a small facility. Congratulations. And had a question regarding payments. I have looked into Stripe and PayPal business for clients to pay online, automatically be billed monthly. But I was wondering if you had any advice or preferences for billing clients, athletes yourself. So great question. I like getting to some business questions on here as well. I will tell you that I love the fact that you want to bill them monthly. I do the same thing. I get people on monthly plans, whether it's for private, small groups, whatever it is. And I think it just makes it easier to track. And I did it early on because I wanted to be able to say, like, I have a consistent monthly income and I know what that is. I did the package system early on. And what I don't like about that is that you end up having a person, let's say, pay for like six straight months of sessions, and now they're a client with you and you're in month four or five and you're no longer getting money from them. You got it all in the beginning, and now there's just a person on your book that like is literally not generating anything in that given time. It was all kind of front loaded. I don't like that. I also think that like it makes it easier for people. Like, who wants to put, you know, $2,000 down on 6 months of training? It's a big investment. You know, I think the monthly part makes it more consistent, easier to do. It gets you on a better schedule. And I do use PayPal. I will send invoices out on PayPal. I use Venmo. You know, just I take checks from people. So whatever really works for you. I don't have an automatic monthly biller because like you can assume that somebody's going to just want to train again. I just send them out separately. I mean, if I had like 250 clients separately to bill every month, I might have, you know, if I get to that point, I'm going to just have someone take care of it for me. But, I think it's all depending on how big of a clientele you have. If you have a smaller group and you could do it separately, you could just send them out yourself. I mean, it's money. I doubt you're ever going to forget to send them out. People don't forget about money. So that'd be my answer on that. PayPal works great. Venmo's an option if you're on a smaller scale. And I think they do have Venmo for business as well. And then obviously checks are good too. So that's my answer on that. All right. Richard Beltran at Richard T. Beltran. I've talked to Richard a couple times. So Rich, and he's a very loyal follower. So Richard, thank you for the question and I appreciate, all the support. What are the best ways to implement strength conditioning for youth athletes, more specifically ages 9 to 13? Great question. First and foremost, don't overcomplicate it. They're 9, 10, 11, 12, 13 years old. If they've never trained before, they're going to get a lot out of a lot of basic things. If they're sprinting, jumping, and just getting stronger, it's going to do a hell of a lot for them. Like, don't get overcomplicated with it. The second thing is make it easy for them to understand and make it easy for them to, I think it's important to give them a goal or an understanding of that what they're doing is going to help them with whatever it is that they want to achieve. So if they are a, you know, baseball player and they want to throw harder, you know, I think it's important to explain to them basically how lower body strength and sprinting and everything can help with that. But even if you don't want to get that complicated, I think a really easy way to incentivize them to work hard and perform well is just making things have a tactical or a tangible goal. Like your training, easy enough. This is something that's talked about all the time, but like timing their sprints to make sure they run hard, like finding ways to get effort out of the younger athletes, which is hard to do sometimes. I think making things competition based, like tapping into that, you know, pride a little bit of like, hey, you know, you're not really loading that fast on your box jump. You're not getting as much out of it. Let's do your next set of jumps on the vertical mat. And I'll tell you your score each time and you're going to get pissed off if your score is not at a certain level. And you're going to work a little harder. So I think that's a really good way to make them work and put what they have, all they have into it. So that's the first thing I would say. The second thing is in terms of structure. If you had to train them one day a week, I would say do your sprints and jumps to begin the session. Do some strength training. Do an upper strength like a push or a pull. Lower strength like a squat or a hinge. And then obviously, you know, work unilaterally as well. I think it's super important to get them training on one leg and keep the core stuff, carries, you know, loaded planks, anti-rotational stuff, things like that. And then in terms of agility, like I think for that age, like getting them in situations where they have to problem solve and you design problems for them. Tyler Yerby said it really well yesterday on social media that we have to be problem designers. Design a problem for them to solve. It could be basic because they're young, but like when they're sprinting, make them react off the drop of a ball, off of your clap, a number, a letter, a color, anything that can get them thinking. Like if you have a group, you know, put the athletes in positions where they're reacting to each other for a little bit of the session in addition to the strength and pure linear speed work that they're doing. And if they have, you know, 2 or 3 days a week, get them sprinting twice a week at least. They're young, their output's not that high. Like you don't have to worry about recovery and burning them out. If they're doing proper recovery during those sprints, like get them sprinting twice a week and jumping twice a week, and everything else will fall into place after that. So that's my answer on that. Thank you for the question, Richard. All right, guys, so we're almost done here. That's all the questions I'm doing from Twitter today, but here's a couple that I have on Instagram. All right. This is from Maine Athletic Performance. As another conjugate-based coach, what have been some things you have adjusted over time for your athletes? Nate Harvey did a fantastic job with Conjugate U, but I always like hearing how other coaches spin based on their knowledge as well. All right, so the biggest thing I think I've adjusted for over time for my athletes, I think, this is good. I'm thinking about this one a little bit. I think that I've realized how you have to be okay with the fact that, like, there's going to be a lot of disruptions and interruptions in training. And I think that's made me appreciate the conjugate system even more, because I think that I've realized how much it gives you in terms of leeway. Like, you know, my athlete has to miss a session because we're in season, but we sprinted, ended strength training on Monday. So they're going to be okay. Like, we're not doing a linear block style training where, let's say they only do power for these 4 weeks and they do strength or vice versa. And they missed half of their sessions in this time because they were really busy with their hockey, baseball, football schedule, whatever it is, or, they got sick. So now I'm totally screwed up in my power area and I got to go to strength now. Like, the fluidity and adjustability that it's allowed me to have, with my athletes has been invaluable, and that's just something that, like, I've really began to see as I've gone along. And I guess in terms of adjustments, the biggest thing that I've adjusted is just my thought process on the order in which I do things. I think I see it a lot more clearly now. I've gone back and forth with the debate of, like, strength training first, speed training second, what's the first thing we do during a week. And I've ultimately come to the conclusion that our speed and power training is always going to be the first thing that we do. Some coaches might say, oh, my guy just had 2 or 3 days off. Like, is it going to be hard to just kind of, quote unquote, wake them up? It's like, if you warm up properly and you're doing things in the right way, it's going to be fine. And I'd rather them sprint before they have done anything. Like, even a recovery circuit, like, let's not touch anything and let's just have them ready and roaring to go. I think that's the biggest thing that's been adjusted for me, is like, that is always going to be the first thing that we do in a given week. And then just my overall thought process, like, the hierarchy of the speed and the power first and the plyometrics first, then the strength training, then the accessories and hypertrophy. I think that's the biggest thing that I've learned, is like, if you follow that order, people think of conjugate sometimes like we're just throwing a bunch of shit at the wall and we're going to see what sticks and we're going to work on everything at once. It's like, no, we have to know the rhyme or reason for what we're doing, and we have to not let, you know, our maybe hypertrophy accessories degrade our strength training work, and we can't let our strength training work degrade our power and our speed work. And then the last thing I would say is just the process, my thought process in terms of why I pick and choose different things. Like, early on thinking, oh, if I'm a conjugate style programmer, like, I have to be doing sprints and speed. I mean, they're going to be done all the time. That's like something that's really never going to change. But, like, I have to be doing sprint, speed, strength, hypertrophy all the time because I'm a conjugate programmer. And it's like, no, it's not the case. I have a testing process that's going to dictate to me when I'm doing these things, why I'm doing them, and, you know, impacting how much of each that I'm doing. And it's like a sliding scale on your car radio. You have your bass, your treble, and you could adjust them based on what you want. And the same thing goes with the conjugate style programming. More strength work, if I have a more base level athlete, who needs to get stronger. maybe all power work or all speed work for an athlete that has a really good base of strength. Maybe I have an athlete that's really, really small and needs to get bigger and put lean muscle mass on. We're going to have a nice focus on hypertrophy. Maybe I have a 200-pound, 21-year-old athlete who needs to get their 40 or 60 time down, and I don't want to do any hypertrophy because I want to, you know, that mass-specific force and the relative strength is really key at this point. And if we could avoid putting any weight on in terms of, like, making them the most powerful 200 pounds they could be, if we put 5 more pounds on, so that's going to make our job much harder. So maybe less hypertrophy work, less eccentrics, more concentric only, and power and speed work. So I think those are the two biggest things I've adjusted to over time. It's just knowing that our testing process has to dictate where we are on the conjugate, you know, scale, so to speak, and how we're kind of sliding along that. So great question. All right, last one, guys. Brian Ten Pereira. Hey, I'm a longtime follower and a dedicated podcast listener, so thank you, Brian. I need your help. My boys, 14 and 12, have been training for 3 years. I'm very happy with the results, but I don't understand why their squat depth hasn't improved. They're stronger, faster, and much more flexible, but somehow their squat is terrible. Thank you. Brian from Montreal. So I will say this, Brian. This is going to be something that's very hard for me to get super specific with. If I can't see them move, I can't watch them do things, and like don't have an idea of maybe why their squat is, as you say, terrible. The thing I will tell you, though, is first and foremost, remember the squat is just an exercise and it's a tool that we use to get other things better. So if they're stronger, faster, and much more flexible and you're seeing that, their times are improving on their sprints and they're becoming better athletes, like I would tell you first and foremost, that's the most important thing. And if you're hitting the nail on the head with that, like honestly, who gives a shit when it comes to the squat? Like gives a shit meaning in terms of like they don't have to squat like they're a perfect Olympic lifter. You know, if their body doesn't allow for it, or if it's maybe just not the exercise for them, like are they really tall? Do they have really long limbs? Like maybe they'd be better off with a trap bar deadlift. Do they have any anatomical restrictions? Like, do they have really long femurs? Do they have ankle mobility issues? Like, are they having trouble, clearing, you know, their ankle and getting themselves in the position? Like, there's so many things I could say in terms of maybe that their squat depth isn't where you want it to be. But I think the good news is I would rather you look at me and say they're stronger, faster, more flexible doing all the stuff that you're doing, and their squat depth isn't exactly where you want it to be, versus you saying like they're nailing their squat and their weight's going up and the squat itself is much better, but they haven't really improved in terms of being stronger and faster and much more flexible. Clearly the squat is doing something if they're improving. Above all else, just make sure that their mechanics are good enough or they're not going to get hurt, and don't keep just throwing load onto it if they're not in that position. I would say the other thing to mention too is understand sometimes that the patterns in a deadlift or a squat can be as much nervous system based as they are physical. I could have an athlete that like is not getting through their heels whatsoever. Their heels are coming off the ground while they're squatting. And so I might say, oh, like they can't do that because their ankles are too stiff, or they have some kind of issue that doesn't allow them to clear their ankles and get into good position. But I tell them, sit through your ankles because your feet are coming off the floor, and just sit back through your hips and everything, and they do a perfect squat. And all it was giving them a cue, which shows that it was more skill-based and of a cue type of thing versus a physical aspect of it. So don't underestimate that it could be that. And also, like I said, if you're using it and they're getting results in all of the other things that are most important, they're not power lifters, right? They're athletes. If the squat and the sprints and the jumps that they're doing are making them stronger, faster, and like you said, more flexible, it's okay. Like their squat doesn't have to be perfect. It can be good enough for what they can do. And if it's safe and they're loading it safely and they're not going to get hurt, we're perfect. So don't go crazy about that. And just, I know I didn't answer. I can't answer too much about why maybe they're not getting to where you want them to, because I have to see them. But I wanted to give you an answer more along the lines of like from a, how should I say, perspective or theoretical answer in terms of how you think about these things and how you would utilize them. I think that would be my answer on that. And hopefully like anybody listening would glean from that like the exercise itself is more important, and if it's helping us get to where you need to get, and if it's not, get rid of it. Like no one's to say that they have to squat versus trap or deadlifting, and no one's to say that if either of those get better, it's going to necessarily automatically make them a better athlete or anything like that. So that would be my answer to that. All right. So I think that had to be 10 plus questions. That was pretty good. I hope you guys are enjoying these and keep sending the questions along, because I love doing these. I hope you guys enjoyed that. And, you know, obviously hit me back with feedback. Make sure you're listening. I assumed at this point that everybody that's writing these questions to me listens to the show, so I don't even answer them anymore to tell them they're on the show, because usually they'll just hear them and they might DM me and say, thanks for answering my question. But I'm going to try to tag everybody that was in the questions this week when I release the show, so it'll make it a little more interactive. So thank you guys, as always, for tuning in. Be sure to tune in on Wednesday for the episode with Pete Dupuy of Cressy Sports Performance. I know you guys are going to love that one, and I will talk to you guys next time. Peace. Thank you for listening to another episode of the Muscles and Management Podcast, brought to you by Challenger Strength. I'm your host, Jared DeFilippo, signing off on the show that's changing the way we view training, sports performance, and business.